HPPodCraft.com.
When late at night, Amar would turn away from his reading, his head buzzing, he would find himself saying, "Impossible. Ridiculous." Then he would take out of a secret little drawer in his desk the silver bullet and contemplate it. Then he would review in his mind all the strange events that he had witnessed since the thunderstorm that sent poor Josephine into the arms of Father Pietermont. And still unconvinced, he would go upstairs and listen at Bertrand's door. If he heard nothing but Bertrand's regular breathing, he would retire to his bed in a skeptical frame of mind. If, however, he heard a strange low whining and the striking of claws on the floor, he would cross himself rapidly and hurry downstairs again, unable to find sleep that night. Could it be that these gory tales of medieval days were not mere delusions? Were there phenomena in the realm of nature, phenomena that perished like animals that became extinct? Could it be that a curious concatenation of causes, a rare and strange plexus of events to be encountered only once in centuries, might produce a monstrous exception to the ordinary course of nature?
Could it be that we have reached part 3 of The Werewolf of Paris by Guy Endori? Could it be?
It can be, and it does be.
Groovy. That concludes the rhyming portion of our show. Welcome to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com, I am Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. We are once again joined by reader Irwan G. Marshall, not to be confused with deceased actor E.G. Marshall, who famously knelt before Zod as the president in Superman 2. I've been workshopping some new names for Werewolf History Month. You know this.
Yeah.
Pretty edgy stuff so far. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been going well. Things haven't been testing. Fresh Werewolf Month tested through the floor. People didn't like it. So
through the floor.
I wanted to test market something different this week. Okay. Something a little more fun. Something that maybe makes you feel, you know, like you're just goofing with friends. Wearing some fresh outfits. Yeah. Keeping it 100 with your squad. You know what I'm talking about.
No, I don't.
So I'm saying my new name for this month. Mm-hmm. Oops, werewolves.
No.
Come on, it's kind of like, you know, a little goofy, a little quirky. Oops, werewolves.
Okay.
Yeah,
good. I'm on board now, yeah.
You understand now.
I got it now.
Oops, werewolves is kind of the plot of this book, too.
It is.
Let me summarize it very quickly. You've got a priest who's descended from an animalistic prisoner, and he rapes a servant girl, and the child of that horrific act is little Bertrand, who now lives out in the country as a boy with his guardian Amar, his mother Josephine, and the other servant Francoise. Bertrand has been sneaking out at night and doing werewolvery things. That all stopped, however, when a hunter shot him in the leg with a silver bullet. Amar pulls the bullet out of the boy's leg. He goes, "Hey, I know what's going on. He's a werewolf." So he goes to the library. He does tons of Oops werewolf research, figures out what it's all about. And that's kind of where we left off.
Yeah.
And it's also what we heard at the top, was him going, "Can this really be true? Is this really happening to Bertrand?"
But now that his ward is a werewolf, Amar doesn't know what to do. He takes all of his research and he sticks it in a bundle and puts it in the shed. That night, he gets a bunch of lamp oil and is going to pour it onto Bertrand's door while he sleeps and then light it so that it burns.
Yeah, he's just going to burn the kid up.
But before he can even get the lid off the jar, Josephine, Bertrand's mom, shows up and he just kind of gives up on his plan.
Yeah, if she hadn't shown up, he would have definitely burnt him and the house down, but it was enough to make him chicken out, and he decides to settle on what he's been doing, which is just keeping the kid locked up at night.
Over time, Bertrand seems to be getting better. Not being able to indulge his bloodlust seems to be stopping his dreams, because they weren't dreams. He was actually turning into a wolf. A few months go by, and Bertrand seems to be a bit lethargic, slow-witted, but normal-ish.
Yeah, enough that he doesn't always have to keep him locked up now.
Then Francoise comes to Amar and says that he needs to start locking Bertrand up again. Amar plays dumb about it. He's like, "Well, I don't. Why would I do that? I don't know why I locked him up to begin with." And she goes, "No, come on, dude. He's a werewolf. It's obvious. His mother doesn't see it because she's got blinders on. But I know, you know, it seems that the fox, quote unquote, is back killing animals around here." And so Amar's going, "Oh, no, not the fox." The fox is Bertrand being a werewolf, killing things.
Right.
So Amar gets an idea. Bert is at lunch, and he's not eating much. So Amar looks into his eye, and he goes, anemic. And the cure? Raw meat.
Aha.
So he starts giving Bertrand raw meat, and it works like a treat. Bert eats raw meat every day, and he's more lively and bright. He's excelling at his studies, and there's no more fox problems. Huzzah!
Swap out that lycanthropy for trichinosis.
Well, his studies are going so well that he decides he wants to be a medical man, and he goes with his buddy Jack to Paris to take some exams. Since the raw meat thing seems to be working, Amar thinks it should be fine.
I don't know why he thinks that. Amar's a little too optimistic every step of the way. maybe this time it'll work out.
They meet another boy and they become friends. But after the exam, they want a party, so they go to this brothel. Mm-hmm. Bert goes off with this lady after having a few too many. In her room, she has this book of autographs with all these famous people that have signed it. So he's like, oh, wow, that's cool. Hard to believe that she's had sex with all these famous people. Yeah. But, you know, he signs his name down. And then after he does, he realizes, he goes, oh, wait, those are fake names. People put in other people's names because they didn't want any record of them being at a brothel. But I just signed my name in this book. Oh, well.
Now, he's shy. He's, like, reluctant to get involved with this prostitute. And she's experienced this before. Her way of getting boys out of their shells is to kind of taunt them and tease them. And so she keeps pushing him, getting him a little angrier. And finally, she gets him into this game where she's like, okay, I'll take off two pieces of clothing for each one of yours that you take off. But she's very tricky about it. She counts her bolo tie as a piece of clothing. I mean, who would count a bolo tie as a piece of clothing? But she does. I mean, she wins the game. He's naked, and she's got to take off her last piece of clothing. And she says, hey, why don't you take this off with your teeth? And he doesn't want to do it, but he goes, oh, okay, I'll give it a shot.
He had caught a piece of her skin between his teeth, along with the material. He heard her scream. He felt a drop of blood oozing through the linen. He had his arms laced about her body. He wanted to release her, but a strange rage had overcome him. Holding her down with one hand, he stopped her screams with the heel of his other hand. She, feeling his hand there strangling her cries, bit down for her part too and fought out wildly with her fists.
Then he blacks out.
This was interesting because Endor is establishing right here that this curse is sexual in nature. The book has been sexual up to here, but this werewolvery stuff, it's not just a random every full moon kind of thing.
Right.
If he gets excited, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
The wolf's going to come out. He cannot disassociate sex with violence. They're one and the same to him. You know, and in that way, the werewolf in this book is explicitly a sexual predator by nature. Which, and that layer adds a lot, you know? Because normally, what, you know, does a werewolf just want to eat people?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Or just run around all crazy, maybe get some beer or... Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, a werewolf's motives aren't always that clear. They just kind of like, I'm a crazy werewolf. But here, it's definitely very much in the realm of the sexual.
So in the morning, the other two boys leave and they pay some of the bill, but they tell the madame of the brothel that Bert is super rich and he'll cover the rest.
Jerks.
Jacques goes back to the inn that they were staying at. Bert doesn't show up, but they have to get their stuff out or they'll be charged another day. So Jacques takes both he and Bert's stuff and then he just goes back home to their hometown. He waits a bit nervously to hear about Bert. And then his mom says, oh, Bert got back and he got a hard beating. And he thinks, oh, geez, I guess his uncle found out about the prostitute. But he keeps his mouth shut. And that's the end of the chapter.
Yeah.
So chapter 8 gives us the other side of the story. The madame of the brothel discovers her girl has been attacked, but she is still alive.
Yeah, they're not too specific about her injuries, but when she opens the door, the prostitute's laying in bed and there's blood everywhere.
They get a doctor, but they don't want to call the police because they're prostitutes and the boys were underage.
And the madam is actually, she's kind of more mad. She's less concerned about the health of the girl. And she says, you know, we could have charged a lot for him to do that to you. Yeah. You shouldn't have done that for free.
But since Bert wasn't so bright and wrote his name in the book with the city from which he is from, the madam figures, why not try and get some compensation? So off for a visit. She tracks down the house and gets an audience with Amar. She tells him what happened and demands 5,000 francs. He tells her 1,000 or he'll go to the police. And she agrees. Then she goes back to the brothel and she tells the girls, oh, the guy didn't have any money. He didn't pay up. Yeah. So we're screwed. But you know what? Since I'm a good person, I'm going to pay for your medical bills. And the girl's like, oh, thanks. You're the best. You're great.
The state is corrupt. The church is corrupt. And now we find out the whorehouses are even corrupt.
What?
It's the one place everybody's supposed to have a heart of gold. Who knew?
So Amar finds Bert at home in bed. He doesn't know how he got there. And he goes, I must have walked from Paris in my sleep. And he asks if he had any strange dreams. Bert did have some strange dreams. And Amar just flipping goes nuts. And he goes, not this time, not this time. And he runs off and he gets a whip and he comes back and he whips the hell out of poor Bertrand. Josephine comes in crying and freaking out. What did he do? She asks. And he says, none of your business. So it's really weird and confusing. She doesn't understand what's going on. Bertrand doesn't really understand what's going on. Something bad happened. The only one that knows is Amar and he's not sharing anything with anybody.
Right.
So the mood of the house is not very good after that assault. And Amar... hopes that he's beaten the wolf out of him.
Well, it's the old saying, starve a cold, feed a fever, beat a werewolf. Who didn't learn that one?
He finally sort of not really apologizes to Bert, but Bert asks if he really did bite that woman, the prostitute, still hoping it was a dream. And Amar is tired of coddling him and says, yes, you did bite her. And I had to pay her a bunch of money to cover it up. And Amar isn't letting Bert go to Paris anymore until they get this mess sorted out. From this point on, Bert is being confined to his room.
He could have taken Bertrand to maybe a werewolf refuge.
There you go.
Would that be a cool haunted experience? Would you go to that if I opened that up? A werewolf refuge? It was like an inn and you have to stay there?
With real live werewolves or just actors pretending to be werewolves?
Well, you know, it's up to your imagination to determine how, you know, how much
you're
going to
invest in reality.
Okay, as
long as I know that they're actors trying to scare me, then I'm okay with it. But if they're actual werewolves.
Scarecters. Yeah, they're scarecters. That's what I like to call them. But you'd come and you'd stay. And, you know, yeah. I'd say, hey, nothing to worry about. There are werewolves out there. Enjoy their howls. We have electrical fencing that keeps them all. And nothing could possibly go wrong. So enjoy your night.
Da, 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 da,
full moon tonight.
Da, 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 da,
shouldn't be a problem at all. I'm going to open that up.
Time passes. One of their neighbors dies of natural causes. Mm-hmm. So there's a funeral. If they don't bring Bert, he would be missed and people would ask a lot of questions. So they take him on the condition that he is on his best behavior. So Bert is perfectly behaved and Amar's thinking, well, you know what? Things might be looking up, but still, I got to lock him at night. Both his mother and Bert think that he shouldn't be locked up anymore. And Amar bosses them around, not explaining why, and says, shut up and do what I say.
For the most part, Bertrand kind of gets it, but that night after the funeral, he's just not wanting to go to his room. He's kind of craving a run through the grass. He's thinking he wants to feel the night air. He's being a little resistant when Amar's telling him to go get in his cage, basically.
So Amar takes that sage advice. Time for beating.
Yeah, he goes out to get his beating equipment, and Josephine says to Bertrand, hey, go to your room. I'll come by later, and I'll unlock the door for you, but I don't want you to get beat on again, so just be obedient for now.
The next day, the grave of the neighbor that has just died has been dug up and partially eaten. Mm. Francois says that Bert was out last night and that his mother unlocked the door.
And Bertrand, when he goes to find him, he's sleeping it off all cozy. He looks happy. Amar knows, okay, he's got a taste for human flesh. The raw meat's not going to work anymore. He ate up on that corpse.
He goes to Josephine and he tells her that he is going to lock up the boy each night. And if she doesn't like it, she can go to the police. She says she will. And he says, good, because then I won't have to deal with it anymore because he will be behind bars. So Josephine is like a little taken back by that. And then she runs to Francois. And Francois says, you better do like he says or things are going to be a lot worse for you and Bert. That ends chapter 8. Chapter 9, Bertrand is feeling the hate and wanting to sometimes kill his uncle. And at other times he's feeling okay. Strange how these seem to coincide with whether or not he would have his wolf dreams or not.
Yeah.
Josephine wants to break her son out of this prison that Amar has put him in within the house. She has been saving up money. She wants to get him a train ticket to Paris and there he can live free. After she gets it all ready, Josephine sneaks into her son's room at night and gives him a bag of supplies to set him free. But Bertrand is half asleep and he thinks it's the prostitute from Paris and he starts kissing her. Now, she tries to protest saying, hey, I'm your mother, don't do this. But he's too strong for her.
She struggled against his youthful, muscular body. Then she ceased and made no further resistance. A strange glow of satisfaction emanated from her sacrifice and caused her features to relax into an ecstatic smile. All the years of her life coalesced. Pitamon, Amar, Bertrand, they were all one. They had melted into a single body, with many arms flailing about her, but with only one face.
Oh, this is so sad. Like, this is what sex had been to her. It's so warped and unhealthy. She still suffers from what happened to her all those years ago. And the tragedy of it all is that they're all victims, all of these people.
It's a deeply confusing scene, as I imagine an incest scene should be.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of maternal, what she does for him here.
Yeah.
She calls it her sacrifice. She knows that it will be a release for him and that he needs it.
Oh, God.
Which is where she derives pleasure from. She smiles during the act. And it says the next morning she's completely relaxed.
Oh, you know. Yeah.
I was trying to think, why is this scene in here? There's obviously just a pure, here's some incest to freak you out. I mean, that works.
Yeah,
but
sure does.
It shows the animal nature here. That societal thing doesn't matter when it comes to the sex because his animal just comes out, right? And the fact that they have this connection during the act is what makes it so complicated. I don't know.
I think you're right. It points out that he is pure base animal desire with no concern for anybody else's feelings.
Once again, it's a rape too. Like, he holds her down and makes her do it.
Oh yeah.
That's all he knows. And she actually, as you say, kind of all she knows is to take the violence. That's something she can do for... it's messed up, man.
So in the morning, Bertrand wakes up with his mother sleeping next to him. And he doesn't remember what happened, but he senses something's wrong, because why is his mom sleeping in his bed with him? He gets dressed and he goes to leave, and he's confronted by Amar. Amar tells him to get back into his room, but Bertrand won't be held any longer. He slams past Amar, and then he bounds out the window 10 feet up. No problem, because he's a werewolf.
Yeah.
He wants to run, so he takes his clothes off and has a wee, and then he goes off running through the woods.
Well, that's kind of a werewolf myth tradition, right? They pile up the clothes and make a circle of urine around them, I guess, to mark the place.
Yeah.
They do bring this up later in the book, that he felt the need to urinate right before he turned into a wolf.
Mm-hmm.
But as he's running, he sees this fellow walking along with a walking stick, and in a kind of werewolfy confusion, he attacks the guy, takes him down, rips his throat out, drags the body back to the hedges, and eats up on him.
In the morning, Bertrand wakes up in the woods. He's naked, and he quickly realizes that the whole thing was real. He sees the mutilated body on the ground, and he recognizes it as his buddy, Jacques. He was on his way to Paris to go to medical school.
Yeah, the whole reason that Bertrand's mother freed him, I mean, there were a lot of reasons, but the primary reason was because she had heard that Jacques, who is Bramon's son, was going off to school, and it made her jealous. I want my son to be able to go off to school too, so I'm going to free him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, freeing him directly led to the death of Jacques.
Bertrand's horrified at first, but then survival mode kicks in, and then he hides the body, and he takes Jacques' bag of supplies and money, and then he remembers where he took his clothes off, and he retrieves his clothes, and then he's off to Paris.
He actually thinks about throwing one of Jacques' arms or legs into his bag for later, but decides against it. You know, his horror at what he's done recedes fairly quickly.
Really quickly, yeah. And he is full-on cannibal mode.
Yeah.
Now. He's just eating people. Even when he's not a wolf, he's wanting to eat people. Now some young farmhand comes walking down the path, and he sees a nice walking stick lying by the side of the road. He picks it up, and he's on his way. A guy he works with sees it and says, hey, you know, that belongs to Bramond. But this farmhand, he doesn't want to give it up. But since everybody knows that it's not his, he kind of looks like a jerk if he keeps it. So he goes and takes it back to Bramond. Now, Bramond thinks that Jacques must have had it in his sack and dropped it, since he didn't really like the cane very much. It was his father, and his father gave it to him, and he's like, But Bramond's wife is worried because it's been a week and they've had no word from him. In a few days' time, they find Jack's body and they think the farmhand did it and they put him on trial. But there's not enough evidence to convict him, so he goes free. But everybody thought he did it anyway, except Amar, because he knows it was Bertrand. Mm-hmm. So Amar wants to see how the trial plays out. But if it looks like the guy is going to get convicted, Amar planned on speaking up. But he didn't want to do it because it might implicate him if he was, you know, keeping a murderer in his house for a long time.
But luckily, the trial plays out such that there's no evidence. So the farmhand is innocent.
Is innocent. Well, people don't believe it. They still they think that he still did it and he just got away with it. And the farmhand ends up killing himself because even his girlfriend won't believe him.
He hangs himself.
And this is in his letter. He goes, I am innocent, but even my dearest Helene thinks me guilty. How can I live? So Amar goes off to Paris to find Bertrand. He knows he will find a trail of misery to follow.
Oh, the terrible disgrace, the ignominy of it, possessing a mythical monster in one's own family in this age of science and enlightenment. This chapter is a little condensed Frankenstein, kind of.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, at the end, Amar is thinking, man, I should have just burned the house down that night, but he was indecisive about the monster, like Frankenstein, and it got out and killed somebody, and an innocent person was wrongly convicted, like in Frankenstein.
Yep.
Very tragic. I do think Amar tried his best, but, you know, it would be difficult to burn somebody alive. So, you know, I mean, I get it.
So chapter 10, Amar is in Paris following the newspapers, hoping to find some clue to where Bertrand is at.
He gets into Paris on September the 3rd. Now, remember, the Franco-Prussian War has been raging, and it was actually the 2nd of September that Napoleon III surrendered. But that, of course, does not mean the war is over, because the French get all mad about Napoleon's defeat. There's a coup and they change the government. But that's the environment he's entering into here in the city.
Yeah.
Napoleon has just surrendered. And he thinks that between all the news of war, he'll probably find a string of crimes in the paper, you know, that might allow him to track down Bertrand.
Mm-hmm.
This is about halfway through the book, and there's an interesting shift here. Bertrand is out in the world werewolving. Amar is hunting him, But the circumstances of the world constantly make Amar wonder if it's even worth it. He thinks,
before the greater importance of thousands going to death, before a greater werewolf drinking the blood of regiments, of what importance was a little werewolf like Bertrand?
The horrors of what people are inflicting upon each other in the name of their political convictions is far worse than any one murder that Bertrand would do. Mm-hmm. And that theme starts to pick up as we pick up steam through the second half. Nevertheless, he finally finds a clue in the paper.
Yes, it seems a girl's body was dug up and her father was killed by her body.
Her body killed the father?
No. By her corpse. It was laying down by her corpse.
His body was found by her corpse.
That wasn't what happened. So we get the story. This guy, General Danmon, is a popular dude in Imperial Paris. He has a little girl who got very sick and died really quick. So they put her in the family plot of the cemetery. So distraught is this general that he wants to visit her grave every day and watch the sun rise there. And he tells the coachman, hey, I want to go visit my dead daughter every morning. I want to see the sun rise at her grave. So you pick me up right before dawn every day. The next day, as he's riding to the grave with the coachman, he thinks about this man and his family and how he's making this poor guy get up every morning to take him to see his dead daughter. So the general is feeling really bad about it. And he tells the guy, you know what? Forget it. I'm going to walk every morning. You spend time with your family. But the coachman seems kind of bummed out by this. And the general asks, well, why? And he says, well, my family's asleep at this time of day. Doing this job, I get paid extra. So I also arranged it with the cemetery guard to have the gates open early. This gig was actually really great for me, so I'm sad to see it go. But the general, he takes out a billfold and gives the coachman a year's salary just right there on the spot. And he tells him, just go be with your family.
But essentially damning him because he just gave him a large amount of money.
Right. Well, yeah. Of course, this isn't going to work out well for him. They get to the cemetery and the gate isn't open yet. He doesn't want to inconvenience anybody. So he and the coachman climb the wall.
They can hear the crunching of their footsteps in rhythm as they're walking toward the grave of the girl. But when they arrive, it seems like a different kind of crunching has happened.
It's a werewolf eating up on his dead daughter.
Yeah.
Then the wolf gets the general, grabs him, gets him, eats up on him, but the coachman escapes. Guess what? Somehow they implicate the coachman for the crime. How? I mean, this guy was obviously attacked by an animal. It's ridiculous that this poor coachman gets pinned for it.
Well, first of all, the coachman had a criminal history, which they make. You know, the saddest thing is that he was actually in jail before, because when they say that they tell his wife that he did it, she's like, I knew it.
Yeah.
So he's already got a criminal history. They hold that against him. Plus, he's got a year's salary in his clothing or at home. So it just really looks like he took the general out there and killed him.
But what? How could he kill him with having a wolf attack? Like, it's obvious he was, you know, he wasn't stabbed. I mean, even forensic science in the late 1800s can tell the difference between somebody being stabbed or shot or mauled by a werewolf.
Tell it to the judge.
Anyway, after reading about this, Amar goes to the judge and tries to tell him that the perpetrator is actually Bertrand Callier. The judge wants to know why he thinks this, to which Amar is hard pressed to give details, and the judge threatens him with jail.
Yeah.
So he leaves. As the case progresses, there does seem to be evidence of a wolf or dog in the attack, obviously. So Amar goes to the authorities and he tells them Bertrand uses this big dog to commit his crimes. And they say, well, you know what? We've set up some traps in the area to catch this dog. 5 days later, nothing. Seems the wolf has moved on. And now we're into chapter 11.
There's talk in Paris about wolves.
You know, I was up in the valley waiting for a meeting not that long ago, and I saw a wolf at the Starbucks. For real.
What?
I was sitting outside at a table, and there was a wolf trainer that was also getting... And so he had his animal with him. This was a wolf. I think he was wearing all this Game of Thrones stuff, so I think it was one of the wolves, possibly from that show.
Oh, right, yeah.
But he just had his wolf with him, and it was really crazy, man. I mean, in my head, they're the size of dogs. But yeah. This wolf stood up on its hind legs at one point. It was a female, too, so it was a smaller one. Uh-huh. And put its hands up on the table, and it was like... It was gigantic.
Oh, wow.
And he goes, somebody walked by and said, hey, can you make that wolf howl? And he goes, of course I can. Oh, and then the wolf howled, and it was this really powerful sound. Yeah. And you saw all these people coming out of the Panda Express and the haircut place thinking, what is going on? Because it's a strip mall, and it just bounced off all the walls.
Oh, man.
Really eerie sound.
You know that guy just takes that wolf out so people talk to him?
Oh, my God. It was such a magnet for people to come by, and yeah, everybody wanted to. But I would legitimately was kind of felt fear being that close to the wolf.
Oh,
because
wow.
I said, okay, it's trained, but if that wolf makes a decision to kill everybody here, we're all dead. Like, this thing is huge. I cannot tell. It was so big.
So Amar's still trying to track down Bertrand. He comes across this name, Geoffrey St. Hilaire, who is a zoologist, which he actually knows from previously, back when he lived in Paris. And it seems he caught a wolf or a dog or something. The article's sort of vague about it. So he thinks, oh my gosh, he's got Bertrand. So Amar goes to check it out. Joffrey is friendly, but just sort of laughs off the whole wolf thing and says, oh, you know, him and his buddies are going to get together this evening for a meal and that Amar should join them. So Amar is like, well, why are you being dodgy about this? But okay, sure. If I got to play this game with this guy, I'll do this to find out about the wolf. They go to this dinner, which is a secret meeting somewhere. And the food that's being served is made from non-meat animals. So they're serving up cat, dog, horse. And Amar is grossed out by this. This chapter goes on for a really long time, just going into so much detail about all the food and how it's prepared. And I sort of feel like this is some sort of vegetarian statement. Why is one animal acceptable to eat and another not? Mm-hmm. You know, in some places in East Asia, people eat dogs. But if you herd a dog over here, people go nuts about it.
Right.
But you eat cows, and in India, cows are sacred. So it's all cultural. I mean, personally, yeah. I don't eat meat. I think it's all horrible. And to me, this chapter seems to be kind of pointing that out.
Yeah, and it's funny because this has nothing to do with the actual wolf, right? Like this is, at the beginning of these episodes, I said there are some chapters that just go off in weird directions. And this is an example of that because, you know, we find out there was no wolf at all. It was just a dog that they ate, right?
At the end of the meal, Amar goes to Joffrey and goes, yeah, tell me about the wolf. And he goes, well, it wasn't a wolf. It was just a big dog. And that's what you just ate.
Yeah, the menu items were pretty rough when they were revealed. It's like consomme of horse, skewer roast of dog's liver, minced back of cat with mayonnaise sauce. All of it sounds pretty gruesome, but, you know.
Yeah, but it doesn't sound any more gruesome than, you know, any other animal to me.
Well, and I think he is trying to point out, look at what people are doing, you know, given the scarcity of certain types of meats, they very easily turn to others and then just dress it up and try to make it sound like it's fancy, but it's still murder.
Yeah.
You know, it's still these folks going out and tracking down animals and slaking their thirst on them. You know, in the About the Author section that concludes the 1941 pocket edition of The Werewolf of Paris, Guy Endor describes himself as, to a large extent, a vegetarian, teetotaler, a non-smoker. In giving up, with occasional exceptions, the use of meat, liquor, and tobacco, I feel I have added to the happiness I derive from living.
Mm.
He concludes, in politics, I tend toward communism and the establishment of the classless society. We're certainly going to see a lot of those opinions.
Sure, yeah.
Soon.
But that's a whole chapter on that. But that night, you know, Amar's feeling bad because he thinks he just ate Bertrand.
Yeah, he's afraid that maybe he just ate Bertrand. That's right.
The next day, it turns out there was another murder that night, so Bertrand is still out there. A man dressed in the garb of a National Guard has killed the prostitute. So Bertrand, he deduces, is now in the National Guard. So we find out that Bertrand had joined the National Guard, but changed his name slightly, and that's why Amar didn't see him in any of the registries.
Right.
And it seems that he spent his money on that he had gotten originally from Jacques on hookers and boozing, but he needed a way to make a living somehow, and the army just worked out for him. So Bertrand would know when his attacks were coming because he wouldn't be hungry all day. So he would lock the door to his room and open a window. Normally, he would awaken in the morning with no memory. But one time, however, he awoke and found a man's forearm under his bed. The hand on the arm clutched a tuft of hair. And he goes, oh, is this from a fur coat? So at this point, he still isn't totally sure he's a werewolf.
That's some denial to go.
Yeah.
So the man was buying a fur coat and there was an accident and I wound up with this forearm? Did I kill Liberace? What's going on here?
He thinks about this funeral that he crashed and this old guy that he was talking to there. He says that the guy, Balis, married a young woman. They weren't married long before he died, and the old man says he saw him 2 days ago and he was fine.
Yeah, the guy's saying he was so old, he shouldn't have married this young girl. I don't think his heart can handle it. And then there's an implication, maybe she did away with him.
Yeah.
You know, once they were married.
So Bertrand realizes that the arm was from the dead guy and the fur was his own.
Mm-hmm.
Finally figures that out. And he wonders how his paws could have pried the lid off the coffin.
I think that there's an implication there, too, that he switches back and forth really quickly depending on what he needs. Which we know that he can do because when, you know, Amar would approach his room, he'd hear him panting and then suddenly he'd be a human again.
Yeah.
But he can maybe even do parts of it. So, like, if he was a full wolf but he needed to hitchhike, he could just, like, turn one thumb back to human. He can do that.
He couldn't afford the good prostitutes on a soldier's salary, so he went for the cheap ones or tricked women that he would sometimes end up murdering.
Oops, werewolves.
Oh. Bertrand would frequent a canteen where a beautiful girl named Sophie would hang out.
She was of more than human beauty. She was slight of stature and could not have been over 17.
Within these limits, her physique was of that perfect variety which transcends clothes, and would have looked as graceful and strong draped in the blanket of a savage as she did in her expensive clothes. Her dusky face was a perpetual delight, for a permanent smile transfigured it and revealed teeth whose whiteness was flawless. Her quick black eyes wandered from man to man, and she had a pleasant word and laugh for all. She was Mademoiselle Sophie de Rubenberg, daughter of the famous banker.
Okay, we have our female lead, finally.
Oh, wow.
She's a rich girl, but working the canteen, and she's being courted by our sort of Gaston, our antagonist, Captain Barrel de Montfort. He's in love with Sophie, and he writes her a new love letter every day.
This guy has been courting her for a while, but the most that happens between them is a bit of hand-holding.
And Bertrand hangs out at this canteen where Sophie works. Once he sees her, he has to keep going back.
Sophie notices that Bertrand is not noticing her, but most of the other guys look at her, but not Bertrand. Mm-hmm. He's too busy being sad.
So she gets attracted too.
So now Sophie comes off as this happy-go-lucky kind of girl, but she has dark thoughts. She thinks about death and being in the coffin and all that stuff. So she's kind of a goth.
Oh yeah, she's goth AF, man.
She's... she's attracted to the dark things, so she finds herself being attracted to Bertrand.
When she sees him, she senses death in him. Says, oh, the opium-sweet attraction of death. And he knows something about her. There's this purity and lightness that he's attracted to. And he's instantly in love with her.
So Bertrand is having a hard time with his urges. So he heats up on that arm that's under his bed. You know, he didn't get rid of it. He just kept it around.
Yeah.
But his thoughts about this pure, kind girl give him strength, helping him resist his urges. And he feels like maybe his love for her might cure him.
He takes all of his body parts and says he throws them in the river. No more corpse eating for him.
So he writes her a little note, Sophie. It says that you rescued me from my nightmares. You are an angel. But it takes him a few days to finally give it to her. But he finally does. And when he does, she writes back to him. And then so they start this communication through little notes. Sophie finally realizes that she is done with the captain, but she can't quite bring herself to tell him to, you know, beat it. So she does agree to meet Bertrand at his house, and he is over the moon about this, but his place, which is normally locked up and smells like rotting meat because of all the rotting meat,
yeah.
He has the people in charge give it a good cleaning. The day comes, and she meets him on the street corner, and he takes her to his room. They just awkwardly sit there for a while. They never really have spoken before, and she gets a bit weirded out, and she starts to leave, but Bertrand grabs her. She freaks out a bit, but he lets her go and apologizes, saying he was never going to hurt her. And she feels bad for freaking out and then decides to stay. And then she tells him to hug her.
You must hold me tighter, she said. Again, he obeyed. Tighter still, she whispered. Such a bliss flowed through her from the feel of his arms about her, from his body pressed close to hers, that her head grew dizzy, her breath came and went. Her body tensed and then seemed about to dissolve in liquid. About to dissolve, but not quite. If only he would press harder, if only he would crush her, tear her, mutilate her. Hold me tighter still, she panted. And still she was on that point of dissolving and could not dissolve. In desperation, she cried out, hurt me, Bertrand, hurt me. Then she felt his arms closing around her like a vice. And within this circle of pain, she experienced a strange exaltation, as if a bird within her had been released and was filling her ears with a wild singing.
So, Sophie is a masochist.
It's a perfect match. You've got the violent sadist with the masochist, and I guess it's a love story now? Sure. Well, I think that's a good place to pause for now. We're going to conclude this book.
Yeah, think on that for a while, folks.
In the next edition of our show, there's actually a lot more to cover in the book, but I think we're going to skim over a lot of the political stuff and just go straight plot. So let's find out what happens between Sophie and Bertrand. I'm sure it's going to end happily.
No, it's not. You already spoiled it at the very beginning.
Oh, well, that's right. I did.
I want to thank Erwin Marshall for doing such an outstanding job reading.
Yes, thank you, Erwin. So glad to have you on the show. And we'll have him back again next week to conclude.
That's great. With that, I am Chris Leinecke.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We're at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.